Good morning, everyone. How are you? Welcome to Edinburgh's first out-of-this-world conference and festival, and the first major UFO conference ever in the Rio Grande Valley. As we open this important event on this special day, March 15th, which is the 60th anniversary of World UFO Contact Day, first established in 1953, we'd like to thank our sponsors. The Dustin Michael Sekula Memorial Library, the Edinburgh Economic Development Corporation, the Edinburgh Chamber of Commerce, the City of Edinburgh, the Convention and Visitors Bureau, Edinburgh Arts, and Best Western Plus Edinburgh Inn and Suites. Without the support of these organizations and businesses, our conference would not have been possible. We encourage everyone to pick up an official full-color souvenir program featuring articles written by our speakers. This limited edition commemorative book also features full color portraits of the speakers that can be used for obtaining autographs. Pick up your copy in the lobby. A very limited number of copies are available. Our first speaker is Dr. Robert Gross. Dr. Gross has been a college professor and teacher for over 23 years and currently resides in McAllen. A former faculty member at South Texas College, Dr. Gross holds a PhD from Penn State University, where his dissertation was awarded a rating of excellent. During his career, he has served as a speaker and writer with more than a dozen articles published in professional journals. He has presented lectures at local, state, and national conferences. Dr. Gross became involved in UFO research in 1985, having joined the Pennsylvania Association for the Study of the Unexplained, a group committed to the scientific study of paranormal phenomena. 4 years later, UFO research suddenly became extremely personal to him as he experienced his very own close encounter of the first kind. Dr. Gross has more than 25 years experience as a researcher with a variety of paranormal investigation groups, including the Pennsylvania Group, Las Cruces Paranormal Investigators, and the Mutual UFO Network, of which he is currently a member. In 1997, Dr. Gross served on an advisory committee working with the makers of the movie Contact, a film about contact with extraterrestrial life based on the novel by Carl Sagan. His topic today is science and the paranormal. Please welcome Dr. Robert Gross.
Good morning, everyone. Again, welcome to the Out of This World conference here in Edinburgh. It's good to see all of you out here. And let me get organized here. As Edward had mentioned to you, this is also World Contact Day. Now, there's a pretty good chance that ET isn't going to be phoning home. So please take this time to turn off your cell phones or at least to the silent position. Thank you. Also, this is a pretty big day for a lot of UFO events. They are celebrating in Phoenix the 16th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights. And again, my name is Dr. Bob Gross. And I'm the lead-off speaker for this event. It's going to be a two-day event. Also, my lecture, to give you an idea of what I'm going to be talking about today, my objective is to get you to think and reflect about the things I'm going to be telling you. We're going to talk about the mind-brain connection. We're going to be speaking about knowledge. We're going to look at science, the paranormal. Science and the paranormal merge together, as well as my own personal close encounter of the first kind. And if we have a little time left, there will be some questions, and then I have an announcement for you towards the end. Science and the paranormal. What I'd like you to think about is this. The paranormal, as far as I'm concerned, is actually the new normal. In 2006, there was a study done, and it was a worldwide study, and it was found that 70% of the population of the world had some type of experience with the paranormal. And in the United States, 71% of the people in the United States had some sort of paranormal experience. Some people are better at understanding these things than other people. This is what research is showing. Now, I'd like to give you a little pretest. All right, now keep the answers to yourselves and please don't cheat on this. But I want to give you a little pretest about the paranormal. Two questions only. Number one, is seeing the future considered to be paranormal or intuition? Now keep the answers to yourself. There was a recent research study done, and what they did was they had subjects who were shown photographs of innocuous things, more or less like little girls and horses and cats and dogs and flowers. But some of the photos were of carnage, of war, and terrible highway accidents. And those terrible photographs were randomly mixed in with the innocuous photographs. And they started testing subjects with this. And what they found out was the subjects were being monitored for their tension. They were had blood pressure. They were checking their blood pressure. They were checking their heart rate, if their palms were sweaty and so forth. And what they found out that the subjects started to anticipate when the shocking photographs were going to come in a random order. They could tell it. So basically, their brains were predicting the future. Just please keep that in mind, something to think about while we're here and reflect upon when you're at home. Question number two. Extraterrestrial life. Is it paranormal or is it increasingly possible? Again, please keep the answers to yourself. Recently, in fact, there were some things on the news this morning. There's now, with the help of some of the recent telescopes, like the Kepler Space Telescope, there are now, they feel, 4.5 billion, with a B, Earth-like planets out there. The nearest potential Earth-like planet is only 13 light years away, meaning it's practically on top of us. And that would be, they're thinking that these red dwarfs have planets around them, and they could be billions of years in advance of us. So if there is intelligent life on them, they could be billions of years ahead of us and only 13 light years away. Here's something that Kepler 22b is a planet they found, and it's only around 660 light years away, practically our neighbors. And it has the same type of habitat and a zone area where the water wouldn't evaporate or freeze. So it's very similar to the Earth's climate. All right, let's move on. Oliver Wendell Holmes, way back in the 1800s, said a mind once stretched by a new experience can never go back to its old dimensions. And that was in the 1800s. Talking a little bit about the mind-brain connection. My proposal was this: involvement with the paranormal, like going to these conferences, enhances the mind and the brain. The mind and the brain are not the same. The mind and the brain are merged. And I selected the word merged because the mind's most recent evolutionary phase that we're going through right now is known as the intellect. And it's the intellect that's responsible for our insatiable need for meaning. The term merged, why I decided to use that instead of fused, is that the term merged means it allows identification of the elements from previously independent entities. Like when you think of two lanes of traffic merging, they don't smash into each other and you end up with a Chevy BMW combination. They're still separate cars and you can tell them apart when they merge. The term fuse implies that there's a loss of individual characteristics. So think of this, that the mind and the brain are merged, not fused. You are not your brain. Your mind is in control of your brain. Now, The term, when we think of mind, brain, we often think of intellect, as I had mentioned a little earlier. The intellect means simply knowing a lot of things. Intelligence, however, means putting that knowledge to use. A man by the name of Howard Gardner, a psychologist from Harvard, who I worked with in the 90s, came up with something known as the multiple intelligence theory. He first came up with, in 1983, with seven intelligences. Then he later added his eighth intelligence, which is a natural intelligence. And then in 1999, he started working on his ninth intelligence, with it, which is an existential intelligence. Now, with the existential intelligence, intelligence number nine, what he's saying is that all of us have the capacity to efficiently learn through and about paranormal phenomena. Phenomena just means events. And we have the ability to use and learn and synthesize information about the unexplained, about unexplained things, to solve problems and to create or fashion products that are of value within a certain culture. Just to give you an idea, the holiday that we usually link with paranormal experiences is Halloween. Okay? Last year, $8 billion was spent, billion with a B, for Halloween alone, not counting other paranormal types of endeavors. Howard Gardner is saying that people with a strong existential intelligence, and all of us have some existential intelligence, it's connecting to a larger understanding. Those people can connect to larger understandings of existence, including things like looking for connections among phenomena, wondering if other forms of intelligent life are in the universe or even around us, and to enjoy discussing questions about life, as well as appreciating the arts and aesthetic experiences. He said that's all wrapped up in this existential intelligence that he's been working on. Now, let's move on to brain growth. Experiencing the unknown, experiencing the unexplained, experiencing paranormal phenomena and other new learning experiences, they are linked to brain growth. One variation of brain growth is something known as neurogenesis. All that neurogenesis means is new nerve cells are produced in your brain when your brain is stimulated, okay? And that stimulation can lead to physical exercise, or as a result of physical exercise, mental stimulation and social connectedness, kind of like you're doing here today, gathering together and talking about UFOs. Remember the term mind over matter? Now the term is mind turning into matter. That seems to be the truth of the fact. Now there's another variation on brain growth. That's called neuroplasticity. And essentially all that neuroplasticity means is that nerve cells in the brain reshape themselves. They reorganize themselves. And again, what causes this? Exposure. Now let's take a look at this. This is how it might look. Let's take the average brain, okay? And this is pretty close to it. So we take the average brain. Now, I did a lot of research on this. It is supposed to be a little humorous. So we take the average brain, okay? And we start going to conferences like this. You start learning new languages like conversational pig Latin and Ebonics, and you start visiting other conferences and getting exciting things going, and brain growth starts to take place. The neurogenesis, the neuroplasticity is going on inside of your brain, okay? Throw in a couple of violin lessons and voila, you're a genius. And seriously, this is how it happens, and you have to be very careful, because you go to too many conferences. Let's say you go to another conference like this next week. You really start studying. You get the entire Rosetta Stone collection, start studying languages, and you start exercising, running 10 miles a day, and this could happen to you. Now, when you see this, now, how would you like to be owning a hat store and see him walk in? But when we see a person with a larger head, a larger cranium, a larger skull, we immediately think he's got a larger brain, which makes him what? More intelligent. Okay? Remember these? The Coneheads from Saturday Night Live. The Coneheads, of course, had a larger skull, larger cranium, indicating they had a larger brain, indicating they were more intelligent. And Dan Aykroyd here could even read a newspaper. So we think of extraterrestrial life, and they were from another planet. I forget which planet it was now. But extraterrestrial life is allegedly to have more intelligence because they have a larger brain. Now, I'm a researcher. I did a lot of researching. I found out that there is actually a local species of conehead that is native to Texas. And it's referred to as this TxDot species. Now, I don't know if they're as intelligent as the Saturday Night Live species, but they're definitely here. I've seen them. Going back to extraterrestrial life, UFOs, and brain cell growth. Again, when you see a picture of an alien, allegedly, they have a larger head, a larger skull, indicating, allegedly, a larger brain, more intelligence. But let's take a look at how this really works. There's Einstein again, a little older picture. They measured Einstein's brain. They weighed it. Now, they did him a favor. They waited till after he was dead. They took a look at his brain, and it actually weighed 10% less than the average brain. So what they're saying here, and research seems to be indicating right now, it's not the size of the brain that counts, it's the shape of the brain that counts. Moving along to knowledge. Knowledge is nothing more than information that's stored in the brain. That information is gained through curiosity. And the more places you can store that information, the faster that you can solve problems. And that's now being thought of how we should be measuring intelligent quotient or IQ. That curiosity is important. You have to be curious about something to really store it in the brain effectively and be able to retrieve it. Now, how can curiosity be harnessed? The answer is this: science. Science is simply describes a body of knowledge acquired through some sort of structured approach. And that structured approach can vary from place to place. But normally, when using what's known as the scientific method, you have at least these six steps. You have observation, there's research involved, there's a hypothesis building that's involved, there's prediction, there is an experiment that's usually used, and then you come to a conclusion after you go through all of these steps based on your research and your study. Now, let's take a brief look at each one of these. Observation. It's the first stage in understanding anything. It means perceiving information through the senses. And that's basically what observation is. The better you can observe, the higher accuracy you have in your scientific method. Next step is in observation. You have, you're bringing in information through the senses, through seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, and smelling. Now, there's also a sense that neuroscientists have discovered it's something known as proprioception, which talks about sensing your position in space. And there's also a sense known as interoception, which talks about the condition of your body, so you can actually sense the condition of your body. Moving on to the next step, research. Research only means collecting information. And when you're a researcher like myself, you shoot for what are known as primary sources, things like interviews, videotapes, autobiographies, things like that, primary sources of information as opposed to secondary sources of information. Hypothesis building simply means you come up with a statement based on your knowledge and your research. Then you make a prediction, which is you're going to predict the outcome of your investigation, what that will be based on your research and your knowledge of the thing you're investigating. You go then to the experiment stage. What an experiment is simply, it's an activity that you designed, a study where you're testing your ideas. That's simply what it is. There's types of true experimental designs and quasi-experimental designs, and there's even descriptive research design. But that's for the experiment. Then, last but by no means least, is the conclusion. That's just a summary of what you found, which is as objective as possible. Now, the paranormal. Remember this from Ghostbusters? Bill Murray. Paranormal basically deals with phenomena. And phenomena are just events that can be measured. Phenomena outside the range of normal experience. Also, you can think of the paranormal as phenomena outside of the current ability of science to explain or measure the thing that you're observing. Typical paranormal topics: UFOs, extraterrestrial life, ghosts, and cryptids. Those are little strange animals running around with hair and so forth. But those are the top basic topics, the four top basic topics related to the paranormal. Also, there's all these other subcategories, anywhere from extrasensory perception down to witchcraft. So that can be all encompassed under paranormal. Now, my experience, personal experience and introduction to the paranormal began somewhere in 1980 when I developed a children's musical. It was called Goblin Gone, based on the paranormal. Scared the hell out of the kids, but they loved it. Okay? And it won a place, second place in the nation as a children's musical. In 1984, my background in science was kicked in. I did a doctorate at Penn State. My dissertation involved a quasi-experimental design, and I was the first candidate, doctoral candidate at Penn State to use something known as a multivariate analysis of variance. As a result, I was traveling around the country presenting my research on behalf of Penn State. So people knew about the research that I had done at that time. My dissertation followed the scientific method. It had observation, research, hypothesis, prediction making, experimenting, and added a conclusion to it. Now, I put those two things together, the paranormal experience that I really was interested in and the scientific experience that I had. I put the two together, and I joined a group known as the Pennsylvania Association for the Study of the Unexplained. And that's my membership card, just to prove it to you. As you can see, I haven't changed much since then. Now, in 1985, this is when I joined PASSAU, or the Pennsylvania Association for the Study of the Unexplained. I contacted them, not because I wanted to join the group, but because I wanted access to their files, because I wanted to write another musical, this time about UFOs and not goblins. So I contacted them, and they said, well, you can have access to our files, but since you're a well-known researcher, you've got to come to work for us. You've got to do research for us, and you've got to be a field investigator. If you agree to those conditions, you can have access to our files. So I agreed to those conditions, and here's my letter of acceptance back in April of 1985. Now, the Pennsylvania Study for the Unexplained, it was a nonprofit scientific research organization, and they were committed to studying the paranormal. It was started in 1981 by Stanley Gordon. It was the Cadillac of investigation units. They had anywhere from scientists down to law enforcement officials involved, as well as the Alcoa Labs and Westinghouse Labs. We had all those two. They were available for our use. This is back when Pittsburgh and that area of Pennsylvania was a booming metropolis, you might say. They also had a research study, a legitimate research study already started. And that would involve seeing if there was a connection between paranormal phenomena and natural phenomena. Two things they found out, at least two things, when I was there. And that is there was a connection between earthquakes and sightings of UFOs as well as sightings of Bigfoot. Another thing that they found out, there were more UFO sightings around what are known as coal tipples. And if those of you are that aren't familiar with coal tipples, what they are is a building like this where there's a railroad or whatever that goes into the deep mine, and they bring the coal out and load the coal into railroad cars and they haul it away. So those were two variables that they discovered were linked to paranormal sightings. We met once a month, except for December, and we talked about sensitive information. In 1987, we started collecting, having meetings where we collected data about UFO sightings. And this is like, the reason I'm showing you this is because we're going to start something here locally. We're talking about starting a local scientific research group looking in, first of all, UFOs. And we'll talk about that a little later. Now, my version of how this whole thing works is that using the iceberg theory. And the way I look at this is the tip of the iceberg, which is above the waterline, is where science is, what we can look at and measure. The paranormal is everything that's below the waterline, which is about 90% of that iceberg. When you take the entire iceberg into consideration, that's reality. Now, let me start telling you a little bit about my own personal experience to see how this all ties in and ties together. I did have a close encounter of the first kind back in 1989. Now, a close encounter of the first kind means that you have a visual sighting of a UFO. That visual sighting, you're within 500 feet of the identified object. Now, later on, if you stick around today, you'll hear Travis Walton speak, and he had a close encounter of the fourth kind. Mine was a close encounter of the first kind. This happened back in 1989. I lived at the base of a mountain in Pennsylvania known as Blue Knob Mountain. And I, because of my background in the arts, I served as a performing arts chairperson. So I had to go out and audition groups to sign up for an arts festival in Pennsylvania that occurred during Memorial Day. So I had to go out and audition groups and then negotiate contracts with them. That was part of my job. On Friday, June 23rd, 1989, I left my home at the base of Blue Knob with a friend. And we drove towards a little place called Ebensburg, Pennsylvania. And I was going to audition a group known as Uptown Larry. Pretty good group, by the way. So we drove to Ebensburg on a route known as Route 22. It was a four-lane highway. And it was a mountainous road. And I had the car that I owned at that time was a kind of a sports car. It was called a Volkswagen Scirocco, a 1984 Scirocco. And it had a little moonroof, but it also had a very powerful stereo system. And what do you expect from a musician, right? So we drove up to the club, went in around 11:30, auditioned the musicians. Of course, there was no drinking, no drugs, anything like that involved because I had to negotiate a contract with them. So I negotiated the contract. My task was done for the night. And we started driving back down the hill. The mountain actually wasn't a hill. So we're driving, we're talking about my passenger and I were talking about what was going, how well the concert went, and they were an excellent group. And while I was talking to her, we were driving. It was a clear night, a little bit of fog, and I noticed something out of the corner of my eye outside the car in the window. And something was behind the guardrail. And something started lifting up from behind the guardrail. Yes. And it started out, it was black in color. Then it turned to like a camouflage color combination, black, gray, and white. And then as it got above the trees, it turned into a grayish white color. And it was hovering there. And things were going through my mind that was unbelievable. More or less things like, that's kind of a big bird. And what's a bird doing out this time of night? And why is it flying but not flapping its wings? And why doesn't it have any feathers or eyes or feet or a beak? And all these things were going through my mind, racing through my mind. And then, as it was hovering underneath these low-hanging branches of a chestnut tree, it moved out and it banked like this. And as it banked, it turned into a glowing green color, much like a luminous watch dial. And I could tell the shape of it was more like a manta ray than a bird. And it flew right at my car. It was like it was waiting for me. And when it flew at my car, it only hovered about, well, it flew right past the roof, the open moon roof, only about 8 inches above the car. And when it did that, the entire inside of the car was flooded with that same luminous green color. And the entire inside, both the occupants, myself, and my passenger, and all of the radios and the seats were flooded with that green fluorescent color. Then as it flew over top, it dipped down, almost hit the road on the opposite side. Then it shot up really quickly at a 45-degree angle and took off at a phenomenal speed up to the northern part of Cambria County. Okay, so we both looked at each other. And at the same time, and I remember this just like it happened an hour ago, we both started hyperventilating. And I was hyperventilating so bad, I had to pull the car over. And we both got out, we regained our composure. And that's when my research started to begin. I realized that it happened too fast to be frightened. So I really wasn't frightened. I wasn't hyperventilating because I was frightened. But there was an emotion. It wasn't emotion like fear, but it was a feelingful reaction, realizing I had just experienced something I shouldn't have experienced because it wasn't anything that I had in my memory bank of information. And that experience was totally unique. And being an artist and a musician, I work a lot with aesthetic experiences. And the aesthetics has to do with the study of beauty. And what I was realizing that the same things I experienced when I started thinking on this and reflecting about this and researching it, the same thing I experienced during listening to a beautiful piece of music or looking at a quality artwork, there's focus involved, perception, cognition, affect, and it was done in a cultural matrix. All of these things happen at the same time. So there were the same things that you experience in an aesthetic experience, if you experience them, were happening in that paranormal experience. In the morning, I reported it to Stanley Gordon. The first thing they told me was get to a hospital with all that green glow that you experienced. You could have been had a overdose of radiation. So and they insisted that I get tested. I got tested later after I started researching, looking at what could I have experienced that night. I started investigating. I found this photograph, and it looked a lot like that shape, but it didn't have all the little lights underneath, and it wasn't that large. So I knew it wasn't that one. It looked a lot like this, except the wings here, they were not as wide here, and the whole thing was that color green. It didn't have these little things. It looked a lot like that, which is a picture of a manta ray-shaped UFO that was taken by another witness, but it didn't. Again, the wings were a little thinner. It looked a heck of a lot like that, but that's a manta ray. It looked a lot like this, except it wasn't orange. It was the same green as that pointer, and the entire body was glowing, not just the perimeter. It looked a little bit like that. That's a snowy owl, but it didn't have any feathers, didn't have any feet, didn't have a beak, didn't have an eye, didn't have body separations. Now, That was in June. In July, I went to another meeting of PASA, and Stanley Gordon handed me a copy of the newsletter that he put out there. And that newsletter he put out every other month. And he showed me that 1 month earlier in May, the same object was sighted in the area I saw it fly off to. And it was sitting in a pasture. And that whole area around it was glowing that same, they considered it a greenish, bluish color, including the fence near it, including the rural mailbox near it. And it was about 1:30 in the morning. And this is the report that was taken. So I started building in my research, again, my scientific method, I started building a hypothesis. And then my prediction was unique aerial phenomena do exist. And subcategories under that, atmospheric anomalies can be self-contained, energetic, and creature-like. Notice I used the word creature-like. I didn't commit myself any deeper than that. Then, they may not be native to the planet Earth, but they frequent the northeastern United States where I was in Pennsylvania. Next, I did some experiment. I had the blood work done. I went to the hospital, they sat me down and they had this huge syringe full of iodine that they gave me a shot right above my right knee. At that time, I was wishing it was a snowy owl. And I had to lay down on a gurney and cameras flew over top of me and took pictures like right next to my nose. They didn't find any additional or abnormal radiation at that time. I visited the site several times, never saw any signs of it. I did notice that there were coal tipples in the area. I drove and tried to duplicate it on even on the anniversaries. I put the same song I was playing that night. It was Take the Long Way Home by Supertramp. I put the same tape in. I drove by at the same time, the same speed. Never saw it again. Then, in 2004, a report came out. A couple saw the same exact UFO that I saw, but in West Virginia. And here's their report that they sent in. And again, if you take a look at it, they say it was a grayish white. It did not turn luminous green, but their sighting was during daylight hours. And it had, you know, no head, no eyes, no tail, smooth surface, the same thing that I saw. And they drew a picture of it. And that's pretty damn close to what flew over top of my car that night. It was doing the same thing to their car, except it was making figure eights on top of it. That's very, very close to what I saw, except after it turned that grayish, whitish color, it turned luminous green. Something for you to think about. In 2006, I was invited to the Houston Space Center for a consulting session. And at that time, they were working on Project Ares. And they had designed a glider that looked like this. And the glider was supposed to be dropped from a space capsule, at which point it unfolded, and then it flew over Mars. It was designed to fly on its own over Mars, gathering information for up to 10 hours. Now, if you believe in reverse engineering, that was almost the exact shape of the object that flew over top of my car. So my conclusion was, the aerial anomaly that I observed in 1989 was a paranormal phenomenon known as an unidentified flying object. This UFO was an atmospheric aerial anomaly that was observed to be self-contained and highly energetic. Things I would like you to think about when you leave here today. As far as I'm concerned, and my research indicates this, the paranormal is merely a comprehensive variation of normal. Human beings with a strong existential intelligence, which we all have a little bit of, according to Howard Gardner, they can learn effectively and efficiently through and about paranormal phenomena, as well as solve problems and create products of value. And the last thing, everyone is born with existential intelligence, and it can be developed to a higher level. I'm currently finishing up a book. The title of the book will be The Nature and Value of Paranormal Experiences, And I'm going to start off with the UFO phenomena. So keep an eye out for it, please. It'll be out there shortly. Now, we have a time for a couple of questions. Any questions? Yes, sir. The UFOs? The question was, what do I think the UFOs were doing? The one that I observed, I would say it was probably observing. In Pennsylvania, even right now, it's still a hot spot. And in areas where there are coal, the UFOs are really reappearing. They're hiding in bins of coal right now. I have a colleague of mine that says there's so many UFOs appearing, and most of them are the manta ray shape, that they had to pull people off the street to do interviews to investigate them. There's so many showing up right now. Yes, and well, let's take one more. It's a very good question. This question is about the fact that I was talking about the size of the brain really doesn't have to do with intelligence. It's the shape of the brain. And could that same theory be applied to dinosaurs? The only thing I would say is that, the dinosaurs didn't have a heck of a lot of stimulating things to cause that brain to reshape itself. So my personal opinion would be it would probably not be a direct correlation, but I'm sure it had some involvement. If there were dinosaurs that lived in very complex situations, in complex environments, I'm sure their brains were shaped differently than the others. Okay, now I'm going to have to wrap this up because we have a very tight schedule today. A couple of things I want to mention. Again, this is the end of my presentation. My name is Dr. Bob Gross, and this is I Up Cards if you see me out there, and this is how to contact me. We are going to be starting a local research organization here. Noe and Steve and I have discussed this, and we're going to focus initially on aerial phenomena, UFOs, because there's been a lot of sightings in this area lately. We will also extend our research into related extraterrestrial phenomena and related credible phenomena. Now, they asked me to come up with some ideas for names for this. I thought of the Southwest Anomalies Team, or SWAT. Well, they didn't like that because I thought, we could buy the hats and everything down at the Army Navy store and wouldn't have to order them specially, but like Noe said something like, one day we could get called out to investigate UFOs above an oil field. The next day we'd have to negotiate some kind of hostage situation. So we sort of scrapped that name. Another name that's kind of in the mix still is the Aerial Anomalies Amigos, or we could just have on our T-shirts A Cubed. And the one I like best is this one, even though it's a little selfish. But Grossbusters seems to work for me. Okay, thank you for coming, and I hope you enjoyed things.